Can you kind of talk a little bit about what the experience has been like for you these last few months, sort of how it came on and what it's been like?
Well, I'm sure it's true for a lot of your audience, Neil, but it's been surreal, right? I can tell you that right in the middle of it, when New York City was in the height of the pandemic, it's very scary. You know, I was coming in maybe 1 or 2 days a week to kind of help manage what was happening at Sinai. About 3/4 of our hem-onc faculty were redeployed to COVID units. They were taking care of patients on the floor and not doing cancer care. You know, when I would go home, I would typically just socially distance from my own family because I was the one coming into the hospital. Yeah, it was really a kind of a very disturbing time. Part of it because we just didn't know. There's so much we didn't know about how to manage the disease and what would happen if we were to have been infected. But, you know, I think we've learned a lot, but there's still so much we don't know. But we're certainly very cautious about now is getting our patients back to Mount Sinai, catching up on our cancer care that was delayed, like in case number 2, and to really not let some of the things that did go by the wayside lead to worse outcomes with other diseases.
Any observations on your oncology colleagues who got redeployed into these other areas, what it was like for them?
Yeah, it was very stressful, I think. You know, we made a lot of accommodations for certain situations. Older faculty, for example, were not redeployed. Pregnant faculty were not redeployed. I'm the chief of the division, so people were allowed to basically personally appeal to me if there were any concerns that they had. And luckily, we had a large enough faculty, and we were able to really help the Department of Medicine and the hospitalists to do their job. You know, it was a very emotional time. It's like being on a battlefield, and it felt very much like people were living in ways that we were not used to, that we had to make decisions on a day-by-day basis about how to take care of all these patients coming in to Mount Sinai. And it was really traumatic for a lot of people.
What came out the other end for you all as a team? Did you find yourself getting closer or farther apart?
I saw tremendous stories of courage and teamwork, and I think it was a really very much a team-building experience. But you know what interferes with that is our continued inability to do the things that really do build teams, right? We don't sit in a room together anymore. And frankly, I miss that. You know, you miss those informal conversations and kind of crossing each other and being able to talk during grand rounds and other educational opportunities. But I think, you know, we're kind of adapted to this new normal. We've all become good at video conferencing. There have been pluses. We've been able to reach out to more patients, and meetings are much more efficient. They start on time, they end on time. But we all miss the time that we want to get back to, which is kind of the normal ways that we do what we do, take care of patients, teach, learn, do research. And yeah, I think it has brought us closer together, but the ongoing challenges make this continuously hard because what do we do in the fall? You know, we're not like grade school, but we have to decide. We have new trainees, new fellows, and we've encouraged them, for example, because there's only 8 of them. We want them to be in the same room, but most meetings aren't held in the same room anymore. So we had to make the conscious decision to allow them to bond, for example, the new first year fellows.
Any observations in terms of communicating with patients via telemedicine? You know, I was just telling you about this case of the non-invasive disease. To elaborate a little bit on, this is a 95-year-old man whose grandson was a urologist, actually arranged for his grandfather to do a telemedicine consult with a medical oncologist in Indiana, who was the person I was talking to. And he actually started the patient. It was pretty straightforward. He'd been on Pembro, gotten a lot of intravesicular therapy. No way he was going to go to surgery. So went through it on telemedicine and actually started the Pembro without meeting him. Which I don't know if you ever did that. He had 2 cases like that. One was lung cancer. The other was this patient. And then he met the patient after he'd had a couple doses of Pembro. He came in to get the Pembro, but he was dealing with him by telemedicine. And first I was curious, you know, what your thoughts are about starting treatment on a patient. You know, he had a local family doctor who had examined him, who was taking care of him, but that issue. And then the other thing I thought was really interesting is I said, well, when you finally did meet him, was there anything that you picked up in him that you really didn't pick up when you talked with him? Because, you know, he had his grandson doing the Zoom and all for him to do it. And he said, I really didn't appreciate the level of anxiety he had about the disease as much as when I really was in the same room with him. And I really felt how scared he was about the disease. Any thoughts about that story?
Yeah, I think that's a very perceptive observation. I'm not sure I would have started a new intravenous therapy without seeing the patient. Part of the reason is they have to come in to get the therapy. You know, you're not going to mail them the bag of Pembro to hang on their own. He had somebody willing to do it for him, so he must have felt comfortable that another doctor at least cleared him on a face-to-face level. Unless it was the doctor, the grandson, who actually hung the Pembro, I probably wouldn't normally do that.
No, he actually gave, you're right. I've been hearing a lot about this, including from GU people. They have patients coming in for LHRH agonist, but they don't see him.
Yes.
They see him by telemedicine.
Yeah, and
that's what he was doing.
Yeah, I have done that too, because they come in, they want to get their PSA. The PSA doesn't come back for 24 hours. They get all their shots and I call them the next day on telemedicine. I think telemedicine actually has been very good. I think that, you know, medicine is a very conservative, fixed in our ways type of profession. You understand this. Docs don't like to change what they do. It's geared towards the doctor and not towards the patient. I sometimes have patients coming from the end of Long Island or Westchester. They spend 2.5 hours in a car and they see me for 15 minutes and they have to pay for parking and tolls and everything. So some of my patients really love it. But I do think that the point that he made about what you miss is really critical. And even though it's 15 minutes, there's a tremendous amount of nonverbal language communication that's happening. And I think, you know, I won't keep doing that for most of my patients. I'm really insisting that they come in, both because they might need a therapy, but also because even if it's once every 6 months, at least I'm able to kind of interact with them and then maybe intersperse some televisits along the way.
And of course, you know, I'm sure you dealt with the issue of people not having access to telemedicine, not having smartphones, not having anything. And that certainly is an issue. But the other side of it, you know, is the issue of whether in the long run, telemedicine will be more infiltrated into clinical research, maybe making it more accessible to people. You know, a lot of people you just described even coming in locally is a real hassle. But I think that's always been a big impediment for clinical research if you have to go to a center. Do you think that maybe in the future, maybe we'll see more of this?
Well, you know, we did a clinical trial with metformin and prostate cancer, and we actually only made the patient come in once at the start of the study, and we gave them a huge bottle of metformin and a huge bottle because it's relatively safe. And they got their labs done locally, but they did not come in again till the end of the 6 months. So it is definitely feasible. Now, doing that with Pembro or doing that with chemo, you can't do that. But I do think you're 100% right. You know, one of my colleagues here, Matt Galski, has some data that shows the farther you live from an academic medical center or a place offering clinical trials, the less likely you are, obviously, to go on the clinical trial. There's a lot of financial and physical barriers. You know, it's a huge issue in cancer. So I think that there's going to be pluses to telehealth. You know, that we can't really see them now, but I think, you know, I have 85-year-old guys on their iPhones. You know, it's pretty impressive. They are getting through. The technology's helping. But I think we have to balance it. That's why I think, you know, the right strategy is to, even for patients like that, is not to just make them do televisits, you know, 12 months out of the year, that to really intersperse these, you know, it's going to have financial issues too. I know they may be getting rid of the reimbursement that they've been generous with, and that can really affect people's practices. You're doing actually a lot of work during telehealth. There's so much work that actually happens after the visit. In fact, if anything, more. We have to track down labs and we have to do this and that. And it's not necessarily easy to do that work. I think if we use it in a constructive way, it's going to be good. But if we try to think that it's just a quick and easy substitute for an in-person visit, I think that's not going to be right.